ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, Dr. Carl here. Back in 1986, I could not wait to see teacher Krista McAuliffe on the Space Shuttle Challenger launch into space.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy. To hear more, search for science fiction and look out for The Challenger Legacy. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
If you're an insect, pine trees are terrifying.
This from a woman who has outrun bears.
Almost every place on Earth that this animal exists was on fire.
She's stared down cougars through windscreens.
And then I took invertebrate zoology and my mind exploded.
She was taught to catch lizards by Jamaican laborers skiving off work.
All of a sudden, these teeny tiny little white things started streaming out of what I thought was its stomach.
She is the hero the invertebrates need.
Superhero super science uniform. Great glue shooting face. Nobody would see that coming. Compressibility of a cockroach where you can squish through little spaces and not get squished. And then I'd go for sort of the iridescence of a Christmas beetle just because it's awesome. And you got to look good as a superhero.
Ladies, gentlemen, humans, bees, bird poo spiders, gnats, I present Associate Professor Tanya Lardy.
This episode of What the Duck was made at a time when the Earth needs heroes. And each hero has an origin story. Peter Parker was pecked by a pesky little spider. And Clark Kent got sent on a rocket to Earth, then was brought up with strong morals by kindly farmers. But we don't need more myths. We need real heroes. Nature's superheroes. So where did they come from?
Well, I grew up in suburban Canada.
I didn't mean literally. The scientist who joins us in this episode of What the Duck, if given the chance, probably would have much rather been out looking at things on the edge of the car park, very closely and for a very long time. But instead, I captured her with a butterfly net and I've dragged the What the Duck microscope out of the cupboard so that we can find out together. How does an invertebrate hero grow her wings? I'm Anne Jones, and this is Tanya Lardy.
I think I was always the kid that loved to be outside. I've always had this real affinity for the underdogs of nature, like all the creepy, crawly things. So I'd spend my childhood running around the creeks and ravines near my house catching insects and snakes, which was safer where I grew up, because I grew up in Canada. There's not really any venomous snakes where I lived. And bringing them home and showing them to my parents, who were about it, even though they weren't super thrilled, I think, to have all of these critters running around.
So yeah, Tanya was pretty hands-on with nature as a kid.
I used to collect slaters, or terrestrial isopods. We called them potato bugs in the part of Canada that I grew up in. And I would borrow my mother's nail polish and put little dots on their little shells so that I could figure out how far away from home they traveled. Because I was really curious to find out, did they stay at the same rock or are they wandering between rocks? And one day when I was collecting one to take a look at it, I had it sitting there in this little bottle cap where I kept them. I called them my little slater beds. And one of them almost flopped on its back. And this is going to sound really gross. But all of a sudden, these teeny tiny little white things started streaming out of what I thought was its stomach. And I was a kid who'd watched Aliens way too young. So my first thought was, oh my goodness, I've got aliens coming out of my poor isopod. What's happening? But then I took out my trusty little magnifying glass and looked really closely, and I realized they were babies. And I didn't know this, but slaters give birth to live young. So they actually have babies that just come out. They don't lay eggs. And people have known this for a long time, but I didn't know it. And when I went and told my parents, they didn't know, and none of my friends knew, none of the other adults around me knew. And so I had this real feeling, I think my first taste of feeling like you've made a really cool discovery that nobody else knew about, even though in reality, everybody probably knew but me.
What are you talking about? I'm in my 40s and I didn't know. I didn't know they gave birth to live young. That's amazing.
Yeah, they do. They store eggs in this little pouch. I think it's called a marsupium. On their underside. So if you look at them at the right time of year, you can actually see all the eggs sitting there. And then eventually you can see the little babies piled in, and it's really cool.
How old do you reckon you were at that time?
Oh, I couldn't have been more than 7 or 8. I think maybe a bit younger.
Okay, Tanya, real talk. Most 7-year-olds aren't undertaking scientific experiments by identifying individual isopods. What's going on there? What's the background that leads to you to be able to almost set up such an experiment?
I don't know. I guess my parents were both in sciences, so it's like I had exposure to the ideas of science. My dad trained as a chemist and my mom was trained as a biologist. So there was a lot of science kind of zipping around the household. But I think a lot of science is a lot more intuitive than people think. You know, you start with a question. In my case, it was like, how far away are these little guys traveling? Because I want to be able to find the same ones. And then you think, okay, how can I figure that out? Ah, I'll put a different drop of nail polish on each of their backs and that'll help me figure it out. So it's not, you don't need to have these really complex, sophisticated ideas. Science is at its heart relatively straightforward. It's having an interesting idea and then figuring out how you solve it.
Was your mum quite glamorous? Because that's multiple colours.
My mum does like her nail polish. So I'm not sure she was thrilled with the use that I put it to. But yeah, my parents, I think mostly for them, what they wanted was for me to stay in school. And they joke that maybe I took that a little too far. Just have never really left school.
You're still at school, basically.
Still at school. I think a lot of it is that, so my parents are from the Caribbean, my dad is from Jamaica, and my mom is from Grenada, which is this tiny little island off of Venezuela. And for them, education was really how you escape poverty, right? So I think for them, education kind of equals security in life.
In the Caribbean, right, did you actually get to go and explore your roots or spend any time there growing up? Because it's a completely different environment than Canada.
It really is. It's drastically different than Canada. Yeah, when I was young, we went to Grenada, my mum's island, a few times. And when we traveled to Jamaica once when I was relatively young. So the two things that blew my mind in the Caribbean were cockroaches and lizards. I had never seen a cockroach. Canada's so cold that, at least the part that I grew up in, you don't really see cockroaches very often. They're super rare and certainly not the big, like, tropical style cockroaches. I would turn over rocks and there would be hundreds of them and I would tell everybody how excited I was and nobody shared my enthusiasm for the giant cockroaches at all. And then the lizards were the other thing. Seeing lizards just walking around in people's yards and inside the house, that was fascinating. And so one day I was out in the backyard playing at my grandma's house. And my grandma had hired some people to do some yard work for her, and they were busily working around a group of guys. And there was me, little, I've been about 10 years old, puttering around trying to catch these lizards. And the workmen just stopped what they were doing, looked at me for a while, and then eventually came over and said, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "I want to catch a lizard, but I don't know how." And all of them dropped what they were doing and spent the next 2 hours training me on the finer arts of lizard catching.
See, I bet they would have loved that because if they weren't lizard catchers as adults, they almost definitely were lizard catchers as kids.
Exactly. Sometimes we lose that joy and fun we have of just getting out and playing in nature. And then we get older and we're not really allowed to do that as much, which is one of the things I love about my job. I get paid to just play around in nature now, which is fantastic.
It sort of seems like a career in science was a given for you. But how was it that you decided on invertebrates to study?
At my university, there were 2 zoology courses, so 2 animal classes. One was called invertebrate zoology, so it was the invertebrates. The other was called vertebrate zoology. And dividing it up that way makes it really sound like those two groups are equal in size. But of course, we know that invertebrates make up 95% of animal species. So the vast majority of animals are actually invertebrates. So if anything, we should have a year or several years of invertebrate zoology and like a week or two of the vertebrates.
Can you imagine?
I know, right? It'd be amazing.
It would be amazing, but there'd be mutiny.
I know. So I took vertebrate zoology first and was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I took invertebrate zoology and my mind exploded because all vertebrates belong to one group, one phylum, the chordata. So all of them. So phylum is like one of the higher levels of classification of life. The invertebrates, I don't even remember how many phylum, but there's 30 plus different phylum groups of invertebrates. So just the sheer diversity was mind-blowing. So every lecture would be a new phylum, a whole phylum of critters that I had never heard of. They all have different ecology, they have different body plans, their life cycles and life histories are wildly different, and some of them are just mind-blowing. And I just spent that whole class with my jaw on the ground being, wow, this is clearly where I need to go.
On ABC Radio National, this is What the Duck. I'm Anne Jones, and we're listening to Associate Professor Tanya Lahti from the University of Sydney. She's an insect ecologist. So you rolled through to a PhD. Tell me about the topic that you studied.
Yeah, so I moved to the western part of Canada, to Calgary, which is just sits right at the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. It's beautiful wilderness. I have always been really interested in behavior, just in how animals make decisions and how they choose to cooperate or not to cooperate with one another. And so the topic I started working on was aggregation behavior in an insect called the mountain pine beetle.
And these beetles are tough customers. You wouldn't guess it because, well, they look brown and beetly. But it takes a very, very brave little beetle to take on a pine tree.
But if you're an insect, pine trees are terrifying. And they're terrifying because if you bite into a pine tree, it responds by secreting this thick, gooey, toxic resin. So for most insects, attacking a live pine tree is just not possible. Mountain pine beetles get around that by attacking in these huge groups consisting of thousands of beetles, all simultaneously attacking a single tree, all of them burrowing together. Essentially ring barks the tree, so it cuts off the tree's circulation system, so it's not able to produce and move that resin around, and that ultimately kills the tree and allows the beetles to reproduce in it. And so my research question was trying to understand how those aggregations form, and in particular, why would any beetle ever choose to start an aggregation? Because it's a super risky thing to do. You burrow into the tree, you release your pheromone, which is like an attractive chemical that basically says, hey, everybody, there's a great tree, come help me kill it. But if nobody responds, you're done for. You are going to die because you can't possibly eat that tree on your own.
And what did you find?
Well, I had a great hypothesis that what was going on is that going first is risky but high reward. If that was true, we expected that all of our first beetles would be like these big, healthy, happy beetles, and they would have been the ones to produce the most offspring. That is not what happened. What happened is the beetles that go first are the skinniest, saddest beetles in the population. Aww. And even if they're successful, they tend to do badly because they've probably been exposed to this resin. So it turns out it's desperate beetles. And what we think happens is if you come out and you're flying around looking for an aggregation to join, that's the A plan. But if you can't find anything, then eventually you're better off starting your own aggregation and at least trying than just flying around till you run out of energy and die alone.
Whoa.
Yeah, so it was a very different story in the end than what I thought it was going to be.
In what way did that experience of doing this over a number of years and having your initial hypothesis completely flipped on its head, in what way did that form you as a scientist?
Initially, I was disappointed, but I think it also taught me that really important lesson that you can never be that attached to any particular hypothesis as a scientist. So now when I do experiments, I tell all my students, it doesn't really matter whether you're right or not. That's not what we're here to do. What we're here to do is generate knowledge and discover new things.
PhDs are often not just about academic development. They can also be really formative life experiences. Mm-hmm. Was that how it was for you?
For sure. I mean, one of the things I learned is that I love field work. It was basically hiking around the Rockies for several years, which was beautiful. And I knew after that, that even though field work is hard, and there are times when you're covered in mosquitoes, and mosquitoes in that part of Canada can be wild. We used to walk around in these big mesh outfits, like a mesh shirt, mesh pants, mesh hood. And even so, if any part of your skin was pressing up against the mesh, you'd come back with just 30 mosquito bites in one place. But even with all of that, I still loved it. I still loved being outside and having those, feeling like you're having adventures every day.
Hmm. I'm imagining those amazing rocky, sheer sort of cliff faces, and I'm imagining a forest of pines. And I'm imagining also, because I love cats, I'm imagining cougars because I love mountain lions. Did you meet any?
I met a cougar on my very first day of research in the Rockies. And I did everything wrong. I went by myself. I didn't tell anybody where I was going.
Oh, no.
I went out and spent hours just looking around, totally oblivious, really excited about beetles. And then just as I was coming out of the woods, I saw something out of the corner of my eye. And my very first thought was, huh, why would there be a pony in the forest? It was not a pony. It turns out cougars are really big. They are probably bigger than you think they are. Like, they are huge, huge, huge cats. And I remember just looking at it and going, oh no, this isn't good. And I was just lucky that I was close enough to my car that I was able to just zip into the car, close the door, and I was able to watch this cougar walk around my car a few times, kind of look right into the window, and then eventually wander off. And the thing about cougars is they're cats, they're stalkers. You don't see cougars unless they're stalking you. And I think I was just really lucky that I happened to leave when I did, because I don't know what would have happened if I'd kicked around.
Wow. Okay, even though the snakes might not be venomous like they are in Australia, there are other dangers in the Canadian outdoors.
If you spend enough time in that part of the wilderness, you'll run into them.
You know what? You are uniquely qualified to actually make a call on whether you choose the man or the bear.
This is true, Ed. I'm going to go with bear because most of the time with bears, you've just startled them and they want nothing to do with you. They want to get away as fast as they can. It's really rare that you'd run into an aggressive bear.
But
I remember there was one time early on when I was crawling next to a berry bush, looking for a particular insect that I'd seen crawl in there. I was like, oh, this is great. I just heard this growl, this sound. Oh, what's that? And I looked over, and maybe 3 meters away was a grizzly bear. And the look this grizzly bear was giving me was like, what are you doing? And so I panicked. I just freaked out. But the thing with bears and other big charismatic predators is that you don't want to freak out. If you run, that can either trigger an instinct for them to chase you or startle them more. And so you want to be very calm, which is really hard to do when you're terrified. So I told myself, okay, I'm going to pretend this is a dog because I'm not scared of dogs and I know what to do with dogs. This is a dog. This is a dog. Just walk away. It's a dog. And I just kept repeating that over and over again, walking away very slowly, walking away, turned a corner. I ran into my field assistant who'd been somewhere else and hadn't seen the bear. And he looked at me and said, what are you doing? And I was like, there's a dog in the woods and we need to go. And he said, what are you talking about? There's a dog in the woods and we need to go. And that's when the bear came over and he looked at me and goes, it's a bear. I was like, I know. And so we kind of walked again very quietly away until we were out of sight and then we ran. When I got to Australia, it took a little while to get used to the idea that I didn't have to yell every couple of minutes. So I'd be walking around going, hey, bear. And people are looking at me like, what are you doing
here? So was that the reason for coming through to Australia? Because you needed to get away from the megafauna that's trying to kill you?
I mean, the short answer is I got a job here. So I was applying to postdocs everywhere. I applied for a lot of ones I thought I was perfect for and got like immediately rejected. Just immediately, which was very disheartening. But I think that's how it is when you're applying for jobs. And I remember this one came across, and it was studying optimization in biological systems using slime molds, bees, and ants in Sydney, Australia. And I was like, wow, there is no way that I'm qualified in any way for that project. But Sydney sounds like it would be a cool place to live for a few years. I then spent like the next 2 weeks doing nothing but studying for this because I knew I was woefully underqualified for it. And then had the interview and miraculously got the job.
It's funny that you think you weren't qualified because there are things that link it because it's about collective behavior or how insects interact with each other.
That's right. And that's the thread that's gone through most of my research, I think, up till now, is that I'm really fascinated by groups of insects. And whether it's groups just cooperating for a very immediate gain, like let's all kill this thing and then every person for themselves, but also those systems like ants and bees, where they're these very carefully integrated collective intelligences, where the group is doing things that individuals could never accomplish.
I wanted to skip forward just slightly because it's 2020 and there are bushfires.
Yes.
So what does your neighbour come to you and say?
So my neighbour in Canada, I got this message from her saying, oh my goodness, I've heard about the bushfires in Australia. So where can we donate money so that we can save the koalas? Was the message that I got. Mm. And it's a lovely thought. But I guess what got me was that, like, I love koalas as much as the next person. Koalas are great, but they're one species. They're one species. And there were potentially hundreds, possibly thousands of invertebrate species that were equally impacted, if not more impacted. And there was almost no attention being given to them. So what do we do for those invertebrate species? And I had a bit of a personal research connection because we had been studying this population of velvet worms, Euparapetodes rolii, the starry night velvet worm, which lived in one small part of one small national park. If you're not familiar with velvet worms, they belong to their own phylum. So they are a completely different thing to any other critter on Earth. Their body plan hasn't changed in about 400 million years. So fossil velvet worms look almost identical to modern velvet worms. They almost look like velvety caterpillars with little antenna. I mean, though they're very cute and squishy, they're also like incredible predators. And they hunt by shooting glue from their faces.
Which I wish I could do. I wish I could do that.
I know. And so this was the only known social velvet worm. And we were investigating how they cooperated to hunt or if they cooperated to hunt and how they raised their young. And so we had the populations of them in the lab for those behavioral experiments. But when the fires went through, it burned almost all of their known habitat. So almost every place on Earth that this animal exists was on fire in 2020. And we were sitting there at home going, oh my goodness, what if these are the only velvet worms we have left or in our population in the lab? And thankfully, that wasn't the case. You know, they are still there, but their population crashed out over the bushfires. You know, it's unclear what will happen to them going forward. Will they recover? Will they not recover? If another bushfire goes through the same area, that could be devastating. It got me really thinking about what is happening to our invertebrates. Why are they being ignored in some ways?
But rather than giving in to the grief, which, I mean, I don't know that I know any scientists that have given in to the grief, though I think a lot of people do get overwhelmed by it. You are sort of driven to action from this?
We were all locked down, and I was spending a lot of time talking to my colleagues, Kate Umbers and Jess Marsh. Jess is an arachnologist, so she does spiders. Kate's an entomologist and a behavioral ecologist. And we were chatting about this, and the first thing we decided to do was write a paper where we looked at the percentage of habitat for invertebrates that was burned during the fire. So we could work out how many species were potentially impacted. And the result was that there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of invertebrate species that had lost 100% of their habitat. So every known place on Earth they lived was burned. And there were many, 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 again, hundreds that had more than 50%. So almost half of their known range is burned.
Then, armed with the data, these three colleagues started to think about action.
We looked around at other conservation organizations to see if there were any we could slot into. And it eventually became clear that there wasn't really. So we started our own conservation NGO called Invertebrates Australia. And so we're now, I think, in almost our fifth or sixth year, being the sort of the voice for invertebrates in Australia.
Got to butt in here with an editorial point because I'm a member of Invertebrates Australia, which I pay for with my own money because come on. Bugs. But to maintain the editorial balance required by the ABC, I'm also a member of BirdLife Australia because they eat the insects. See?
You know, I'd argue you can't be doing conservation if you ignore the invertebrates. Mm. They are the majority of life. They do all the things. You know, there are pollinators, there are waste managers. You know, many of the insects and other invertebrates that people don't like maggots and cockroaches, they're doing the hard work of recycling our waste so that we're not stepping in poop whenever we go outside. They're super important. And yet we see them and go, ooh, gross, reach for the fly spray. These animals are doing an important job for us. And, you know, even beyond that, I think one of the things that always kind of gets me a little bit is whenever I start talking about velvet worms or, you know, dung beetles or something else, the first question I tend to get is, well, what are they doing for us? What's the important role that this animal plays that affects humans? But I bet nobody asks the koala people that question. No one goes to a koala researcher, well, what's the economic value of this koala? You know, what is it doing for us? We just accept that koalas are unique Australian animals that are thus deserving of our conservation efforts and our care. And we don't often have that same sort of grace for invertebrates.
And that's funny in a way because Australia loves an underdog. So maybe it's time to take a leaf from super science hero Tanya Larty's playbook and get out there and cuddle a roly-poly today. Don't actually go touching animals unnecessarily. They're under enough stress. I meant, you know, metaphorically to hug your local potter wasp. Associate Professor Tanya Larty is a What the Duck science superhero. And thanks to her and to everyone who's spoken with us so far in this special little series of nerdy conversations on What the Duck. I'm Anne Jones. Go on, look after yourselves and the world around you. We produce this program on the lands of the Kulin Nation.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.